Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find Here Be Monsters now at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm going to continue to stand with the people that are being oppressed. To me, this is something that has to change. And when there's significant change, and I feel like that flag represents what it's supposed to represent, and this country is representing people the way that it's supposed to, I'll stand. This stand wasn't for me. This stand wasn't because I feel like I'm being put down in any kind of way. This is because I'm seeing things happen to people that don't have a voice, people that don't have a platform to talk and have their voices heard and affect change. So I'm in a position where I can do that, and I'm going to do that for people that can't.
Colin Kaepernick continued to protest during the national anthem last night at a game in San Diego. He was joined by teammate Eric Reed in taking a knee during the Star Spangled Banner. In Oakland, Seattle Seahawk Jeremy Lane sat down during the anthem as well. These NFL athletes are not the first to protest the state of race relations in America, but they're being called unpatriotic by critics in a world where competition and patriotism are linked. Why do professional sports and patriotism go hand in hand? And can athletes criticize the state of their country without losing support in the arena? Howard Bryan is senior writer for ESPN. Welcome.
Hello, thank you.
And also joining us, David Leonard, professor at Washington State University and author of the forthcoming book, Playing While White, Privilege and Power on Off the Field. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Howard, let's begin with you. There is a history of protest when it comes to sports in America. I'm thinking of the 1968 Mexico City Olympics when the runners Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists during the anthem. Of course, Muhammad Ali protesting the Vietnam War. How is it different or not different to what Kaepernick is doing today?
Well, I think it's part of a lineage. I think that you can make an argument, as I believe in, Professor Leonard, I'm sure, has very strong opinions on this as well, that to me, the black athlete in 20th century America very well may be the most important or most influential black professional during that period because of the visibility and because of that heritage, whether you're going from Jack Johnson to Jesse Owens to Joe Lewis, to Jackie Robinson, that the black athlete was the most visible athlete or the most visible African-American professionals, but also what made African-American players different from, say, musicians and entertainers was this promise of sports. It's codified in our language, the level playing field, that sports was the promise of a meritocracy that had been denied African Americans in so many other areas. So when you see what Colin Kaepernick is doing, it is part of a black heritage. It's part of the heritage that is bigger than he is, it's bigger than this issue, and it's gone on for more than a century. And I feel that what is really taking place right now is, after a 30-year dormancy, silence, really, you're starting to see this new generation post-Ferguson, they are paying attention to sport and society in a way that we really hadn't seen. This is sort of a break of the Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods, O.J. Simpson legacy, where the athlete had been far more connected to commerce, had become that sort of individual corporation.
Mm.
It's a change.
Yeah. And David, we did see LeBron James wearing an I Can't Breathe t-shirt and other NBA athletes, but is there something particular about the NFL that makes this especially potent? I think we lost David there. Well, I'll pose that to you, Howard.
Well, absolutely. And I think part of it is that the inherent, or the, I don't know if it's inherent as much as it is, as much as it has been cultivated over the past half century, relationship between the NFL and the sort of military attitudes that the sport likes to sort of impress upon its players, that it is connected somehow to patriotism in a way that maybe the other sports aren't, because of the team elements, because of the brutality of it, because of the sports metaphors that sound sort of grotesque in a lot of ways. And in times of real war, you listen to players talk about going to war with each other and being in a foxhole, mm-hmm. and all of these different cliches that football has really sort of mastered. And I think that also in post 9/11 America, football has been the sport that has really tried to commodify patriotism and inject sort of patriotism into its game day more than the other sports.
Mm, interesting. Well, David, we have David back now. Let's talk about that in terms of whether or not there's some kind of cohesion or not amongst the team and the team players, and what's happening with the white players, and whether or not they are siding with Kaepernick in this. Many are actually criticizing Kaepernick, but, you know, Howard just said that there is this metaphor of going to war and that we're in a foxhole together. Why don't they feel like they're in the foxhole together on this issue?
Yeah, it speaks to the limitations of these ideas and the narratives around sport as quote unquote brotherhood.
Absolutely.
or family, as Howard mentions, the kind of connective tissue between the language of the military, because not only do we have an overwhelming number of white athletes who have come out and criticized Colin Kaepernick, but these are the same athletes who have been silent. Who have been silent about a myriad of issues, from war to police brutality to police violence to what's happened in Flint, Michigan. And so all of a sudden, they're connected to these issues and are going to use their platform, and are going to use it to not only speak up about these issues, to in many ways criticize and even silence Colin Kaepernick and those who would take similar stance.
Well, what about black players, other black players? Are they, not a lot of them are doing the same thing as Colin Kaepernick. Not a lot of them are speaking up.
There have been a few. And clearly the criticism directed at Colin Kaepernick has crossed racial lines. But when we look at the number of white players who have spoken up in criticism, that's part of it. But it's also the way that they've criticized him, the way that they've created no space to engage what he's talking about.
That's right. And that's key.
Go ahead, Howard.
I was going to say, no, I'm sorry. I'm just agreeing with you. That's the key. The conversation isn't even about what Colin Kaepernick is talking about. And what I find really sort of odious about all of this is the sort of different components of the machine. And I blame my industry especially on this. Then you bring in players and you're asking players to discuss patriotism. This is not a conversation about patriotism. And the area that I find, as much as we discuss the NFL, which is obviously the big dog in American sports, it's a $12 billion industry, and it also has so much of what David is talking about, where you've got it's 67, 68, maybe 70% African-American, yet the NFL has never had a black owner. I actually look at the NBA, which is 77% black, and look at the number of white players and white coaches and white owners who have profited off of LeBron James and Carmelo Anthony and all of their talent. Where is Kevin Love right now, LeBron's teammate, about this? Do we have a connection? Do you know anything about the lives of your teammates? And it's a huge departure from the 1960s, where if you talk to guys like Tim McCarver and Mike Shannon and a lot of those guys from the great St. Louis Cardinals teams, and they would talk about how connecting with Bob Gibson and Lou Brock and Bill White and Curt Flood, actually discussing the 1960s and having fights about it in the clubhouse, and learning about each other actually made them better people. It made them lifelong friends. It made them tougher when there was two outs and the bases were loaded, that they all sort of came together. Those conversations are not taking place in 2016.
And David, why do you think that is?
Well, I think one, as Howard points out, the broader media discourse has not empowered white America to have these conversations in a post Obama presidency, in a post civil rights moment. The language that is deployed creates conversations that really go nowhere. The fact that we in the aftermath of Kaepernick's sitting down, you know, people invoke his millions of dollars.
That's right.
As if that insulates him from the violence of racism, as if being disconnected, even if you believe that, precludes one from speaking up. The false equivalencies that play out. But I also think, as much as the ascendance or the resurgence of Black athletic protests in the last few years is connected to the power of social media, not only in terms of the way that Black athletes are using social media, but the way that social media puts athletes in conversation with activists, with those on the ground in Ferguson and Flint and so many other places. But social media is also creating levels of disconnect. You know, we have a country where, despite social media, 75% of white America doesn't have a single Black friend. And clearly, athletics points to the limitations, because here you have NFL players who probably would say, and probably through their everyday interactions, have Black friends. Yet there's a disconnect in terms of the understanding, and worse, the empathy for both history and everyday experience today.
Yeah. And Howard, isn't there a fantasy, and maybe you could address this, that football and professional sports in general kind of display our idea of a post-racial society, that here you have a mixing of all sorts of people, and they're all coming together for a single shared goal, and there really isn't any racism on the field?
Well, it's also a castration in a lot of ways, where what we're really talking about is that post-racial ideal is rooted in one thing, and that's money. You make too much money, as David said. You make too much money to speak. You make you have a contract for $114 million. Or I was talking with CeCe Sabathia, the pitcher for the Yankees. He signed an 8-year, $160 million contract back in 2009. And I was asking him a couple of weeks ago at Yankee Stadium, are you having these conversations about Ferguson, about Minneapolis, about Baton Rouge, with your teammates? You're the elder statesman. You're one of the only African Americans in this room. And he said, you can't have those conversations in baseball. And it's very difficult to have them in baseball because, one, all of these white kids, who are just kids compared to CeCe because they're in their early 20s, they already believe that they know my life. And they know nothing about any of where we come from or who we are. But their opinions are so rooted in concrete. They're so cemented. Yet they have no idea. So he was discussing a certain frustration with the fact that there's not a lot of listening going on. And I sort of attribute that to one of the things that David was saying, was that one thing that our social media has done in terms of creating discourse is created that sort of echo chamber amen chorus, where you have opinions that you agree with that get reinforced and reinforced and reinforced, and we're not really coming together, even though you could make an argument that the locker room is one of the few areas where you have true African-American dominance in a given profession.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. We're out of time, but thank you both very much for a very interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN. The working title of his upcoming book is War Games, Patriotism, Sports, and Protest in Post-Ferguson America. And David Leonard, professor at Washington State University, his forthcoming book, Playing While White, Privilege and Power on and Off the Field. And we want to hear from you. What do you think of Colin Kaepernick's protest? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, LA is so much about youth and trying to preserve it, but there are older people living here. We begin a series that looks at the lives of some who live along Broadway. Today, a look at loneliness as people age. That's next on Press Play.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. And one way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. You can put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off, too. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Life as a senior in Los Angeles can be lonely, especially if leaving the house is difficult. That's Patty Balbaneda's predicament. She is 70 years old and has struggled off and on with depression and chronic pain. Today, independent producers Roxandra Guidi and Bear Guerra bring us a story from their Going Gray in L.A. series about a woman who has found her sense of purpose at the local senior center.
Give vegetables to everybody. And this must be the end of the time.
Patty shows up at the Senior Activity Center as soon as the doors open. It's 8:30 in the morning. She's wearing black tights and a t-shirt with her signature long, dangly earrings. Her back is hunched over as she pushes a walker. Behind her, more graying men and women, some moving faster than others. She first made the walk into this building 10 years ago. She was 60 years old, curious, and unsure of what she would find inside. She wasn't sure if she belonged here yet, whether she was old enough to be considered a senior. She sat down by herself at a table in the back of the room. Within minutes, she remembers being surrounded by people.
And they saw that I liked the Mexican music, and they started being really warm, and they'd fix my collar, and they would ask me questions, and they would laugh at my jokes.
One of those people was a woman who would come to mean a lot to Patty. Her name was Margaret. She was 20 years her senior. Patty remembers.
She was very sociable, and she was funny, and she was, you know, she was a lady.
Mexican Americans like Margaret are a majority here in Lincoln Heights. But Patty is of Irish descent, the güera, they called her affectionately, the blonde one. Patty calls herself a Latina by association. The father of her kids was Mexican, and she has always felt more at home cooking and eating black beans and rice.
Ella completo 90 años.
Over the course of 30 years in East LA, Patty's learned broken Spanish.
Feliz cumpleaños.
At the center, Patty will grab a cup of coffee and a pan dulce, a sweet bread, and head over to her regular table, where she sits with other ladies for hours, chit-chatting.
I thought my life was over at 62. But when I started coming here and I saw all these people, all these characters, and they were all here and they were all still coming every day. One old man in a wheelchair with no legs, he kept on getting kicked out because he was grabbing ladies' butts. And life goes on.
The vibe isn't much different from high school. Patty says people here gossip about one another. They lust for each other, and they make friends for the rest of their lives.
I mean, crushes, romances, marriage. You just have to keep going, and then I wouldn't want to come.
But Patty did come, often, to see Margaret. A couple of years into their friendship, Patty noticed that Margaret's dementia was getting worse, so Patty took Margaret under her wing, making sure that she could find her way back home and that she ate well.
At that time, she started to resent me, okay, because I really watched out for her, and the family didn't want her to leave. She lived about 3 blocks down on Daly.
Margaret would sometimes lash out at her, but Patty saw a sense of purpose in caring for her older friend. Last year, Margaret passed away after a long struggle with Alzheimer's. The news hit Patty hard. Her best friend was gone. And for a while, so was Patty's motivation to get out of her house. It's a hot summer afternoon around 2. Patty's bare feet look swollen and pink. The fan is running in the kitchen of her apartment, yet the air is heavy.
Every morning I wake up all full of aches and pains. You know, my knees hurt, my shoulders hurt, my arms hurt, my back hurts, everything hurts. And I'm slow.
At first, the feeling was overwhelming. Suddenly, she realized she was older. Except, unlike Margaret, she faced chronic pain.
I wake up in the morning, then I take my pain pills, and I sleep, and I get up and I eat, and I think, oh, I have to take a shower. Oh, I have to put my clothes on. Oh, I have to paint my eyebrows. But by the third day, I can't stand myself. I mean, you know, I'm pretty stinky by then, and I haven't gotten dressed. I've just thrown one loose muumuu on after another.
But eventually, people checked in on her, one of her daughters, the lady at the corner store where she buys her cigarettes, a friend from the senior center.
But it's getting from here to the center that is hard. I mean, that's hard. Even if I have transportation and I make the excuse and I say, oh, I have to get the trash and I have to do this and I have to do that. Nobody's going to do it but me, so I don't go. And half the time, I don't even go do the things I said I was going to do. And somebody,
why is that?
Well, it seems like from here to the trash can is about 500 miles.
But depression has a way of making every movement, every interaction, more difficult. Social alienation is common among people over 65, especially those with disabilities or chronic illnesses. Most of the seniors coming through hospital emergency rooms in L.A. are actually coming in due to bouts of depression. Outside of the senior center and home, Patty spent a lot of her time shuffling back and forth from doctor's appointments. She has a hernia that will eventually have to be fixed and needs to get work done on her teeth, most of which are now gone. Once a month, she heads to the Lincoln Heights Senior Center to pick up 2 big bags of free food. Disabled seniors like Patty get to the front of the line.
This is part of the frustration of being old, okay?
She's 41 on the list, but she's misplaced her number. She's searching frantically inside her purse and pockets.
My fear is that I'm going to have Alzheimer's, and then I think it's a fear of everyone, that they're going to forget.
But it turns out the number was inside her pocket after all.
And that's mine. They didn't give us a raise, okay?
She shows the food bank staff evidence of her need, her Social Security check worth $875 a month. After splitting rent with her daughter, she's left with only $400 every month. This must cover some meals out, cigarettes, her meds. She loads the goods on her walker as she makes her way out. An elderly Chinese woman approaches her with a bag of dry pinto beans and points to Patty's cans of corn. They cannot communicate with words, but it's pretty clear she'd like to make a trade.
Want the spaghetti?
No.
What?
Oh, corn.
Okay. You want 2 cans for 1 bag? Oh, all right. Yeah. Only because I have corn at home. Okay? Well, you're welcome. Are you guys allergic to cats?
No.
Back in her apartment, Patty shows me a picture. In it, she has gray hair and all her teeth still.
I was 60 in this picture, or 59. And look how much weight I had on. And I look much older. I'm not, my hair's not fixed. I have on sweats.
She's lost a lot of weight since this was taken. She's also gone through another bout of depression. Quite simply, she says, it's a recurring sadness about how she keeps on getting old. But these days, Patty is finding the motivation to meet new people and go to the senior center every day. And recently, she's made a new friend.
Of course, my family's so glad I'm interested in somebody again, that I have a companion, that I have a friend, you know. And I bring out something good in her, okay?
Kind of like Margaret, Emily is a Mexican-American woman and 10 years older than Patty. She's shy. Patty is not. At the senior center, she's earned a new nickname, no longer the blonde one. Now she's Big Mouth. Patty calls Emily the new Margaret. But Patty would also like to be known for doing for her friends what she would like them to be doing for her, getting them out of the house and making sure they don't sink into sadness, like she has so many times before. For KCRW, I'm Ruxandra Guidi.
You can see pictures of Patty and the Lincoln Heights Senior Center and hear more stories on our website, kcrw.com/goinggrayinla. KCRW is able to bring you these stories with the support of the Eisner Foundation. Coming up, our Friday film reviews, including a melodrama saved by its two stars, Alicia Vikander and Michael Fassbender.
These are two people that could have chemistry with a wall, you know?
That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Labor Day is upon us, but just because it's the end of the summer movie season does not mean there aren't plenty of movies coming out this weekend. We're going to talk about some of the weekend's new releases with Roth Cornett. She's editor-in-chief of Screen Junkies News. Hi.
Hello. It's good to be here.
Great to have you back. And Amy Nicholson, chief film critic for MTV News and host of the movie podcast Skill Set. Welcome back, Amy.
Hi, everybody.
Hi. Well, let's start with White Girl, a movie that people have been buzzing about since Sundance in January. It's about a young girl who goes to New York and goes wild, as in Girls Gone Wild.
That's a 20 bag right there.
You should come to a party with me tonight in Chinatown. You could sell all this shit.
No, I don't fuck around over there, yo.
What, in Chinatown?
No, like in the city. I don't fuck around over there.
What do you mean you don't fuck around in the city? It'll be fun.
Okay, Roth, you saw this movie. A lot of beeping there. What's happening?
I did. I actually saw this movie at Sundance, and it was one of the very few movies there that I truly hated. And I'm still not sure if that was the point. You know, if that this is a film based on first-time director Elizabeth Wood's actual experiences, but she's also merging that with an attempt to create a metaphor about white privilege. And it's effective. But it is
criticizing it, I assume.
Sure. Yeah. Well, certainly criticizing it. But it also takes sort of the stance, if you're looking at it through that lens, that those who are blind to their own privilege are also repellent human beings entirely. Right. Like, there is no joy to be had in this film. There is no pleasure to be had. The main character, the white girl, is played by Morgan Saylor, who you may remember from Homeland. She's a college student that's decided to go to New York and go wild. And she has this catchphrase, "I always figure it out." And that becomes emblematic of what the white privilege is. No, you don't always figure it out. It's just much easier for you. And so she starts a relationship with this young Puerto Rican man, and things go haywire, as you imagine they would. And at the end of it all, as the dust settles, there are consequences for him and none for her. And there's something, I can't decide if it's reveling in this or if it's being revelatory, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense.
Is it critiquing it? Is it saying we are messed up as a society?
I think it is. I think it is. But it's completely lacking nuance. You know, I mean, first of all, Morgan Saylor's performance is being hailed as bold and brave, which it certainly is. She's going for it. But she's going for it. She's at 13 the entire time. It's so heightened. There's no subtlety to it at all. And because of that, it just becomes the metaphor and not much else.
So people are comparing it to Kids, that Larry Clark movie from 1995.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
for its, you know, very accurate and vivid depiction of kids doing bad things.
Which is interesting because I would also liken it to Catherine Hardwicke's 13, of a girl, the idea of a girl out of control, which I actually really like 13. I liked Kids as well. Here's the thing about Kids. Kids, for me, I grew up in New York City and I grew up with those types of kids. And I grew up as one of those kids. And for me, it was almost like, yes, this is exactly what it felt like. And much of my experience was similar to this. However, what it was lacking was heart and soul. It acts as if these kids have zero moral compass at all, and that's not true. They're just lost and confused and young and sort of stupid. So that's sort of where it fails. It tries so hard to make the point that it misses the point a little bit.
Are you talking about Kids and this movie?
Both, I think. Okay. Although Kids is a better film.
Okay, next up, Morgan, about another girl gone wild, only this time this girl is an artificial humanoid.
Morgan was our third attempt, our little breakthrough.
It's the next step in evolution. It's bioengineered with synthetic DNA.
Within a month, walking and talking. Within 6 months, it exceeds our wildest expectations.
I'd like to discuss the incident, if that's okay.
Okay, so Morgan, she's gone wild. What's happening there, Amy?
So Morgan is a android who's been like raised as a child in this laboratory. She's 7 years old in Earth years, I suppose, or actual years. But in the film, she's aged so fast that she's a teenager. This is another one of those films where a researcher goes to a lab, meets a very human-like cyborg, tries to figure out if this cyborg should be put down. And we've seen a lot of these.
Ex Machina, for example.
It's Ex Machina. It's related to Blade Runner. And if you see the Blade Runner in this film, if you see shades of Prometheus, if you see shades of Alien, of this group of coworkers who are at each other's throats because they're isolated and have nobody else to talk to, that makes sense. Because the director here is Luke Scott. That is Ridley Scott's youngest son. And Ridley Scott is actually signed on as an executive producer, which makes Morgan feel like a film that's really just a passing of the torch. Like, hey, kid, do you want to get in your old man's business of making these sci-fi films that look like they have a lot to say but actually aren't saying that much?
Yeah, the sexy cyborg gone
Yeah,
bad.
The agent who always wears stiletto heels in the forest. And you're like, come on, Kate Mara, get some sneakers on. I mean, it's very ponderous. I feel a little bad picking on it for its DNA. I mean, this is a film about DNA and about lineage and about how human are we. And that this film has all of the sins of Luke Scott's father's films, where there's clunky dialogue, where actors who are supposed to be human don't even seem human, where it doesn't matter really who's a robot because everybody feels very artificial. And so you're just watching this hoping that something interesting will happen, and nothing really ever does.
Do you agree, Rock?
I do. I wanted to like this film more than I did ultimately, and I would have to agree. First of all, there's a twist that is telegraphed from literally frame one of the movie. You know what the twist is. So it's sort of when it's revealed, it feels more frustrating. It feels as if you've doubted us as an audience. You're doubting our actual intelligence in your exploration of artificial intelligence. And it begs comparisons, absolutely, not only to Ex Machina, which is, again, a superior film. I feel like I'm being so negative today, but also to Ridley Scott's films, which I would argue are also superior films, particularly Blade Runner, to the point where a friend of mine left the film saying, talking about a character as a replicant accidentally.
Okay. Well, speaking of Alicia Vikander, who starred in Ex Machina as the robot, she's in a new movie as a human, a period romance called The Light Between Oceans. She and Michael Fassbender are a couple living on a remote Australian island where he's the lighthouse keeper.
I want to see where you hide yourself away.
I'm afraid that would be against Commonwealth rules. The only woman allowed on Janus is the keeper's wife.
Then marry me. What are you laughing at?
You'd have to have rocks in your head to want to marry me.
Roth.
I wish I had good news for us. I really do.
You're going to hate this one too.
What is wrong with your programming today, Roth?
I don't hate it. Look, it's a lush film. The performances are beautiful. The cinematography is gorgeous. But Derek Cianfrance, who delivered Blue Valentine, which is this blood and guts look at relationships, gives us what is essentially an entirely predictable morality play that is so interested in affecting you emotionally that what it does is leave you cold. Mm. Having said that, I've spoken to several people that were truly heartbroken and crying throughout the film. So maybe I am Morgan and soulless and a cyborg after all.
What is the general plot outline?
So the general plot is that Michael Fassbender is a World War I vet, and he is really emotionally shattered, and he's gone to work at a lighthouse by himself and sort of nurse his wounds there. He falls in love with Alicia Vikander. Who would not fall in love with her, right? They suffer two tragic miscarriages, and then they find a baby and a dead man in a rowboat, like you do.
And happens all the time.
They make a choice as a couple, and then the rest of the film is about the consequences of that choice.
And because there is another woman who appears.
Yes.
Dot, dot, dot.
Dot, dot, dot. Rachel Weisz is the real mother, and yada, yada, yada.
He's got to choose between the two women.
No, he doesn't have to choose between the two women. He actually has to choose between his own moral compass and, using that word again, and his love for his wife, right? That's actually the choice.
It sounds like it could be very interesting.
Yes.
But it's not?
It could be very interesting. The problem with it is that it devolves into, look, the performances save the film, ultimately. But in terms of the story itself, it really is a soap opera. It's an absolute melodrama. Nothing about it surprises us. Even in the moment when you feel like you're about to be surprised, you're not. The end is almost shockingly contrived. And I just don't think at the end of the day, it does much more than beg you to cry.
What about the chemistry between real life couple Fassbender and Vikander?
I mean, it's off the charts, but these are two people that could have chemistry with a wall, you know? But so that's great. And there is a level of romance and love. And certainly there are big questions asked in terms of what choices would you make given these circumstances. But unfortunately, it ultimately falls flat.
Bummer. Okay, finally, Kevin Smith has a new film out. It stars his daughter and the daughter of Johnny Depp as two Canadian yoga-loving teens named Colleen. They're both named Colleen, fighting an ancient evil.
Destroy everything that threatens anyone or anything that you love. That's the yoga way.
We can do this. We do tons of stupid stuff with our adults all the time.
Okay, Amy, what is this movie about?
You might be expecting more bad news this week because this is a Kevin Smith movie starring his daughter and Lily Rose Depp as convenience store clerks who you might have gotten a glimpse of in his last movie, Tusk, the movie where Justin Long becomes a walrus.
Of course. I missed that one, unfortunately.
Well, you know, maybe you shouldn't have missed that one because Kevin Smith has been doing some strange things lately that everybody hates and I kind of love. He's been making these retro, weird, campy, absolutely over-the-top, very, very stupid genre movies that I find hilarious because at least they're different than everything else we're seeing in theaters. They're not trying to get at the meaning of life. They're trying to have Lily Rose Depp kill a killer hot dog who is also a Nazi. This makes sense, sort of, when you see it. No, it doesn't. It never makes sense. But this is a movie where you use yoga to kill hot dogs in a convenience store. As a person who eats a lot of hot dogs in convenience stores, I was dumb and happy.
This, though, has gotten a 21% on Rotten Tomatoes. People loathe this movie.
I think a lot of things are setting people off about this movie. You have Kevin Smith returning to a convenience store. You have him going back to the territory of Clerks. You actually have characters saying, I shouldn't be here today. And I think people are upset to see him do that, and they're upset to see him do a movie that's just this dumb. But what really works to me about it is, you know, his daughter Harley Quinn and Lily Rose Depp are best friends in real life, and their chemistry, like Vikander and Fassbender's, just pops. You know, they obviously adore each other. They have their weird little shorthand. This is a movie that tries to make fun of the way millennials talk. There's a lot of Instagram and emojis and them having subconscious conversations over their phones while adults are talking around them. But they're having so much fun and they're in a band together. And Lily Rose Depp is guaranteed to be a movie star.
Hmm.
Even if she didn't want to be, she looks like the perfect synergy of her parents. She has all the connections of her parents. It's inevitable. And so this will be a movie we'll either watch later after she gets her first Oscar and be like, oh, look at that dumb thing she did. Or we may as well just be on board now. I'm going to vote be on board now.
You sound like we're powerless to resist.
We are. We're all just bots in the machine.
The power of that. Can I ask a question? So I loved Tusk. I'm one of the few people that love Tusk. I'm on the DVD. My quote is on the DVD for Tusk. That's how much I love this film. But everyone has told me, even so, you will not like this film.
Tusk has this strange bleakness to it that mm-hmm. I really like, that I think you like too.
I do.
Where it gets dark. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is sewn into a walrus. He is not mutated through magic. It is pain and surgery and stitches and his screaming eyes like sticking out of all of this blubber. There's a tragedy to Tusk that does not exist at all in the world of Yoga Hosers. It is definitely just brighter and more bubblegum.
Yeah. Well, also in Tusk, the more he's stripped of his humanity, the more human he becomes. I mean, he's a terrible human being at the start until he's sewn into a walrus.
You might be happy, though, that Justin Long, the walrus, is at least back here as their yoga instructor.
So it's old home week. It's old home week at the convenience store. All right. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Amy Nicholson, chief film critic for MTV News and host of the movie podcast Skill Set, and Roth Cornett is editor-in-chief of Screen Junkies News.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Sometimes observing teens on their phones feels like watching social rituals in a nature documentary. It's really hard for us, #olds, that's what they call us, to keep up. And that makes sense because it turns out teens actually have a complex set of rules and etiquette online. And if you don't follow them, it could ruin your chill. Mary H.K. Choi embedded with some teens to learn their language for her recent piece in Wired. And today she's here to share what she's learned.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Well, you're pretty brave embedding with the teens.
They were very kind, actually, and forgiving, so that was good.
Okay, so you have a diverse group.
Yeah, we do indeed. I mean, that was kind of a huge priority, you know, just to have a representation. First of all, I really wanted girls and boys, and we wanted them to be sort of geographically scattered. And for me personally, as a person of color, I am Korean. I really wanted to talk to people of all races, so that was a huge deal as well.
Okay, so do different groups and do boys and girls use different apps or use them differently?
Absolutely. There, you know, if Ahmad, who was a bit older, he used it much more as a flirtation tool, whereas the young ladies I spoke to used it predominantly to communicate with friends.
And they're using Instagram? What are they using?
So here's the thing. This is kind of the breakdown that totally stunned me, which is that they do all use Facebook. So we often think of Facebook
as
being
what?
Like... Yeah, they do. But they use it like we use LinkedIn, which is like invariably
not
that frequently. Exactly. You're like, what is my login? So basically they use it as a public facing curriculum vitae. So it's like, it's for them to post their extracurriculars. It's for their mom's friends to sort of see what they're up to, their aunts, their uncles, things like that. They very rarely update it themselves for their friend group. And in fact, one of the girls I spoke to told me that snitches who tell on you to your parents is who reads Facebook. So you have to be very careful.
So the lowest of the low.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to be very careful there. The thing that most surprised me, though, is that the way they use Instagram, because Instagram by now, a lot of us, even the #olds or the washed, as they say.
The washed?
Washed. So you're just kind of like over. Is they update and delete a lot of Instagram posts. So even if you've been on the platform for like 2 years, a lot of the teens whose accounts are private will then go and prune. So they might have 1,000 followers, but only 5 pictures.
Oh, why do they do that?
I think it's because they're big into like curation.
Yeah.
And so they're into what their grid looks like, which is the landing page that shows all of their photos versus each individual image. And they feel like does their most exemplary of themselves and their aesthetic. So this is almost like kind of like a headshot, I suppose.
And then you write that there's nothing more embarrassing than a deep like.
Yes. So we've all done deep likes, which is that you're kind of, you know, in the images from about a year ago. And you accidentally double tap and put a heart on it. So that betrays a lack of chill, which is very important. You know, I talk about in the article that when you have the tools with which to stalk anybody all the time, the person who appears to be doing the least and caring the least comes off as the most cool. Mm-hmm. Hence the fact that deep like is a no-no, which I feel like all of us can kind of identify with, because if you accidentally like your ex-boyfriend's photo from 2 years ago, you come off as
pathetic.
That's
really embarrassing. But you can unlike it.
You can, but oftentimes if they have a push notification set up to something that you like, they might see that and then see that you try to undo it, which is also really
even worse.
Exactly.
Oh, gosh, so much pressure. Well, so they're on Instagram, but they're also on Snapchat.
Snapchat is a huge one. I think Snapchat tends to be the most mysterious because, you know, there's a sense for parents that there's a lack of control in the fact that everything disappears within 24 hours. So it feels like a very unsupervised realm. But the thing about Snapchat that kids really like is that it is so ephemeral. The fact that, you know, they've been sort of drilled into their heads since they were really little about digital footprints and how, you know, so-and-so didn't get into Harvard because they were partying with the swim team and posted all these things to Instagram and Facebook and people found out. Like, they have all these lessons in their minds, and so they're a little bit freaked out when they use social media platforms that feel too permanent. So with Snapchat, they can actually be free and silly. And so a lot of the dispatches that they'll snap to friends, like within personal messages, is basically just like a hey. It's a close-up of an eyeball or a nostril or their shoe. And it's just like an indication of boredom. It's just like poking your friend to be like, hey, what's up?
So it's like a visual text.
It is a visual text. And it's really about the fun of that and about keeping in touch with your friends without
and then
like
keeping
pressure.
A streak going.
So streaks are really good. It's like it basically incentivizes and gamifies keeping in touch with people. And so while texts can be a big chore because you might have to think of an original response, or, you know, you're trying to like keep 20 texts going or a group chat, or there's so many ways that you have to communicate, mm-hmm. that just being able to shoot your friend a photo of like your knee or like what you're looking at on TV is just such a throwaway, and it's so casual, and it does signal that you love your friend and you're thinking about them, but it's not a lot of work for you.
But you have to respond. There is some pressure because you have to respond to their photo within a certain amount
right.
of time so to keep the streak going.
Yeah, it's basically like a volley, and you have to keep that going every day. And then you get the prize is like you get different sort of emoji. Once you get 100, you get the 100 emoji. And
okay,
so,
let's talk about emojis because
yes.
there's a it's like another language, really,
it
using
sure
the right
is.
Emoji. Okay, what are some of the emojis that are used most often, and what are they used to communicate?
So the moon emoji, which I'm a huge fan of, is the one, you know, that has kind of a sideways smirk. And that one sort of indicates awkwardness, or it's kind of like derp, where you're just like, you did it like a social faux pas and I'm on to you, but I'm not trying to embarrass you or be mean about it. So
it's not like the one with the befuddled face with the hand and you're kind of like, that one.
Oh, thinking emoji.
That one.
Is the best. I feel like that one and the upside down one are quickly becoming my personal favorite. And thinking emoji is basically just like if someone asks you to do something and you're not really that stoked on it, perhaps you'll pretend to think about it a little bit. That one is like a very convenient catch-all for like participation, except kind of not.
What about the gas station emoji?
Okay, so that signals like gang, which I was just like, gang isn't gang. And he's like, ew, no, like stop being so dramatic. It's just like, basically it's just like squad, but for guys.
But why gas station?
Because it's got the little G on it. It's got a G on its chest.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, hanging out at the gas station. No.
No, it's not like that one Zoolander scene or anything.
Right.
No, it just seems like gang. It's just kind of like, yeah, like fam.
All right, what about the smiling poop? My personal favorite.
Smiling poop is great for everything. But the thing that surprised me the most is the smiling emoji. The smiley face is probably the most, you know, original and old school emoticon emoji ever. But Ahmad was telling me that if you get one back after you're trying to incite a flirtation, that was an immediate shutdown.
Oh.
So that ends.
You'd think that would be encouraging, a smiley
no,
face.
No, not at all. Not at all. Apparently, if you get one, that's like the death knell for any possible romantic ventures in the future. It means thank you, but
no
thank
you.
Yes. And who knew? I had no idea until he told me.
What's the opposite? What's an encouraging one?
Apparently, Monkey Bashful Face, the one covering its eyes, is particularly good. So if you've paid someone a compliment over Instagram and they send that, that means that they're not so gassed or like so up on themselves that they think they're amazing, but they're still kind of open to the invitation of a continued flirtation.
Okay, so your article pretty much presents a wholesome teen world when it comes to social media, even though a lot of us hashtag olds think that it's full of danger and they're doing bad things online.
Sure, and that's like the part that I really wanted to go talk to them for. It's like when we say embedded, it sounds like, you know, a deep anthropological dive. And a lot of the clickbait surrounding teens and a lot of the things that you'll find with like anonymous texting apps like Yik Yak and Kik and all this stuff are about like sexual predators and all these negative things. But oftentimes I just feel like the things that bubble up to the top in a 24-hour news cycle and the zeitgeist can be sort of alarmist. And while these things are true and they are dangerous, I wanted to talk to teens and kind of talk to them and not about them.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I found the most reassuring, though, is that the level of involvement of their parents. But that's the most important thing in terms of keeping your kids safe.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot. I learned a lot. Except now that if I start using these emojis, I'm sure my kids will start using other ones because how embarrassing. Right?
I know. They'll have to migrate to something else entirely. Well, so many celebrities now have their own emoji packs, so maybe they'll just go on to like bespoke emojis without us.
Okay, another thing to keep track of. Mary H.K. Choi, a writer at Wired, where you can read her article on teens and social media. Thanks, Mary.
Thank you.
Julie Myers, you need an emoji for yourself.
I was terrified of teens when I was a teen. And I feel like now, I know she was supposed to like make us feel better about what's happening, but I
don't. The horror.
A crushing sense of FOMO right now because none
of
this.
Edvard Munch emoji.
yeah, exactly. That's
scream.
Me. That's me right there. Well, and now I'm feeling awkward about all the smiley emoticons
right,
that I've sent
you
to you in the past.
You get now I know what you were really saying.
It's thanks, but no thanks. Come on.
Yes.
Okay. Well, some people were saying thanks, but no thanks to Colin Kaepernick online in our various social media feeds. But many people supported him and his protest. Brian P. Smith says that flag worship isn't patriotism. And bless Kaepernick for bringing it to the forefront.
All right. Well, have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And you guys have
smiley
a great
face.
Weekend. Yes, exactly. Hashtag smiley face. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Tuesday.